J'accueille ici aujourd'hui Paolo Bassigalupi, né en 1972 dans le Colorado. Il y habite toujours avec sa famille, d'après ce que j'ai pu comprendre. Vous avez obtenu le prix Hugo du meilleur roman en 2010, le prix Nebula du meilleur roman en 2009, le prix John Wood Campbell Memorial 2010, le prix Locus du meilleur roman en 2010, le grand prix de l'imaginaire 2013 pour La fille automate. Votre roman Ferrailleur des mers a reçu le prix Locus du meilleur roman pour jeune adulte 2011, tandis que La fille flûte et autres fragments de futur brisé obtenaient votre second grand prix de l'imaginaire, si je ne me trompe pas. Ce n'est d'ailleurs pas votre seul prix français, puisque La fille automate avait également rempli le prix Planète SF des blogueurs en 2012, dont on vient de vous remettre le prix aujourd'hui, puisque vous étiez absent. Alors, ma première question, c'est, nous connaissons un petit peu l'auteur Bassigalupi, vous êtes déjà venu nous voir en 2012, mais j'ai envie de savoir ce qui s'est passé dans votre vie avant l'auteur. Qu'est-ce que vous avez fait avant d'écrire, Paolo?
Okay, so yeah, I originally did not think I wanted to be a writer. Originally, I thought my parents were hippies, and they were very not traditional, and so I thought I wanted to have a real job in a real office in a cubicle, and I wanted to live in a nice subdivision where a house looked like everybody else's house, and I did not want to live in a teepee, and I didn't want to. I wanted to live a traditional life, a traditional American life, and. I tried it. I studied Chinese language when I was in college. I worked in business in China. I tried very hard to be a serious business person and make money and do those things. And I hated it. I was very unhappy. I switched from that to programming. In the early days of the internet, I was an internet developer, a web developer. I worked for a consulting company in Boston for a while. There was some moment where I really liked the technology. I thought it was amazing what the internet was doing and how it was changing everything. But I hated the work of working for big companies, trying to market products on the internet. There was nothing interesting in that, and so I started writing as an escape from that day job life, and it started as a hobby. It was something I did on the weekends, and then I wrote more and more, and there was a moment when I realized that writing was the only thing I actually enjoyed in my life, and that was the moment when I thought, oh, I'm going to become a novelist. I want to become a novelist. I was in my 20s. And the feeling got so strong that eventually I announced this intention to become a novelist to all of my coworkers and quit my job and said, I'm going to write a novel. And off I went, and I spent all my savings, and I did write a novel. And it was immediately rejected by every single publisher, and it was a total failure. And I had to go back and get another job because I was out of money. I got another job doing internet development. Those computer jobs were really good because they allowed you to build up a little bit of savings, so then you could quit again and write another novel. And I did that four times, actually. I would write a novel, run out of money, fail to sell the novel, go get another job, save up money, then spend it all writing another novel. And I went back and forth like that. I did that four times, failed every time, and eventually just accepted that I was never going to be a novelist. After writing four novels that had all failed, I just knew it wasn't for me. I wasn't going to succeed. But I loved writing still, and so I started writing short stories. And I knew it was going to be a hobby then. I got a real job, and I would write on the weekends again, and I would write these short stories. And almost immediately, the short stories started to sell. I think I learned enough over the course of all of those bad novels. And they were bad. Every novel that I wrote was terrible, actually. Looking back, they were all very broken. But I learned things from that process. And so when I was working on the short stories, suddenly something worked, and they started to sell. And then they started to get a lot of critical recognition and started to be nominated for awards, and it was a strange moment because I'd given up on the idea of being a writer, and then suddenly I was actually succeeding as a writer, and slowly, you know, over the course of a couple of years of writing short stories, my ego got back in the game, and I sort of thought, okay, maybe this time I can write a novel, and so then I sat down and I wrote my fifth book. And once again, I did the same exact thing that I did every time, which was I quit my job and used all my savings to write the novel. And this one, though, it turned out to be, even every single major New York publisher still rejected that book, that fifth book. Everybody rejected it again, which I thought was like just, it was like, oh, of course they do. Like, I can write short stories, but I'm not meant to be a novelist. But there was a small publisher in San Francisco, Nightshade Books, and they bought Wind Up Girl, and then it turned into a phenomenon. And none of us expected what happened with it. Even Nightshade, who bought the book, they thought they were going to lose money. And so they were like, we like this book. We don't think we'll sell any copies at all, but we really like it. And this was a publisher that was literally two crazy guys in a house in San Francisco. They weren't, you know, they were a very small press, and then suddenly the book blew up. So, and then I was a writer. After that, like, it all changed. Everything changed. And
heureusement que l'édition n'est pas une science exacte. Alors, j'ai envie de vous demander, ils sont vraiment super mauvais, les quatre romans d'avant? Vous les sortirez jamais? Vous les reverrez jamais?
No, those books really are, yeah, terrible. I think there are things that I could fix them now. I think I know enough that at least a couple of them I could fix. At this point, I have other ideas I want to work on. And so, you know, those, it's not as interesting to me to fix those old books because those are sort of like it's a little bit like going back to your childhood or something like that. It's not the part of your life that's alive and interesting now. And so I've got other new books that I want to work on, and they're pressing, and they're the ones that are demanding my attention. I probably, you know, I never say never, but I think right now at least there's other things that I feel like I'm desperate to write. And those other ones, they can sit. So.
C'était juste par curiosité de lectrice. Vous avez déclaré que la science-fiction était le seul genre qui vous avait donné les outils nécessaires suffisamment puissants pour décrire l'évolution du monde, voire le monde tel qu'il est. Est-ce que c'est la fonction première de la science-fiction, selon vous, dire le monde? Votre fiction est-elle aussi politique que scientifique?
Well, I think that, so for me, one of the things, and this probably comes from growing up with hippies, is that it feels very self-indulgent to write stories, just to write stories. And the truth is that the reason why I read is because I love stories, I love adventures, I love to be sucked into a story. But at the same time, it feels like you want to be maybe of use to the world somehow. And so you sort of feel like if you're going to cut down a lot of trees that you ought to have something to say, or something to illuminate, some idea to explain, at least some idea to explain, or at least investigate somehow. And so for me, at least, what I find is that with a story, I want there to be a question there. For a book, especially, I want there to be a question that I can investigate, and that if there is one, then there's enough room for me to sort of go into that book and sort of explore it. And it does feel like it's with purpose. It's for joy, for certain, but it's also with some purpose. I think it's a strange mix of, like, you know, I certainly have my own, you know, personal political views, my own values. Those definitely inform my writing. I don't quite feel like the... I don't feel like the story, I hope that the stories themselves don't feel political, I guess. I hope that the stories feel genuinely like stories. I hope that though, I think the thing about science fiction is that it gives us this interesting set of tools where, I guess the way that I think about this is I think about science fiction as being able to give us context about the world. The way that I think science fiction works is that we can look around at a trend or a moment now, and it's not very meaningful because the important things haven't happened yet, or they happen very slowly. So if I'm writing The Water Knife, and I'm thinking about climate change, and this is an abstract problem, and the details of the problem are also fairly abstract and small. You say, oh, there's a drought happening right now. Oh, well. Oh, you know, perhaps our rivers are running a little low. Oh, well. What does that mean, though? What happens if this goes on? What will the world look like if the climate data that we can turn to climate scientists and ask them about, if their climate data is real, then what world will we inherit in the future? And so what I think of science fiction as being able to do is it stretches us out into this future where we get to live in the skin of our future selves. Science fiction, all fiction, is an empathy engine. Fiction helps us connect to things that are different from us, for people who are different than us. And so I think science fiction allows us to cross over into living inside of our future selves. Like, we can connect to that future self who otherwise is fairly uninteresting to us. We're very good as human beings at identifying with our present moment, our present needs and wants. We have a very hard time waiting or emphasizing our future selves or our children's lives. Those are abstractions for us, largely. What science fiction can do, though, is it can let us live inside of that future version of our decisions. And so if I can give a reader the experience of living as a climate refugee, someone who has been displaced from their home and has had to cross many states where people hate them and has been stopped by border controls and can't get to someplace safer or better because of it. If I can give the reader that experience of living inside of that climate refugee's skin, then if I connect that to the physical details of our present moment, and, you know, in the Water Knife, I'm writing about the southwestern United States and the Colorado River, I can make a reader, after they finish the book, ideally, they'll come back into their present moment and they'll be looking around and they'll read a story about drought, or they'll read a story about how the Colorado River is running low, or how Lake Mead has just hit record lows. And these are things that they would never care about before. They wouldn't even notice. And yet now I have a reader and they'll say, oh, I just saw this article about Lake Mead. And suddenly, that because they've lived in that future moment, their present moment has context. And I think that's what science fiction does. And I think that's what I'm interested in doing, is creating a context to have a better discussion about our present moment. I don't want to preach to people. I don't want to say, oh, politically, you should have these values. I want people to experience something in the future and then have a different way of looking at the present. Sorry, I just go on and on, don't I?
Yep. Non, non, c'est parfait, continuez. Et d'ailleurs, on va aborder la même question, mais sous un autre angle. L'un de vos romans jeunesse, un des moins science-fictifs, qui s'approche plus du thriller scientifique, selon moi, s'appelle La Fabrique du Doute. Un très beau titre pour décrire une très vilaine entreprise qui consiste à discréditer la parole des victimes de technologies ou de médicaments foireux, on va dire, pour qu'on continue à les commercialiser. Bien qu'on soit loin de l'intrigue du roman en soi, là, votre science-fiction est-elle également, dans un sens complètement différent, une fabrique du doute?
Well, it's all manipulations, isn't it? I mean, the difference between propaganda and information sharing is, I think, a fine line. You know, I mean, and that's, I think that, you know, when I wrote The Doubt Factory, I was very interested in the idea that there are companies that their jobs are to spread doubt about what truth is. Their professional focus is creating confusion about scientific information. Doubt Factories started the doubt industry started with Big Tobacco. And tobacco companies hired scientists to try to create false science and false narratives about how dangerous tobacco was. And the really interesting thing about that was that the people who worked to try, it started with Hill and Knowlton, was the public relations company that really pioneered a lot of the doubt techniques. But they, you know, to call science into question, to create false studies or alternate studies that were skewed in some way, to question the motives of the scientists themselves. There's a whole playbook, essentially, that Hill and Knowlton created to discredit the idea that cigarettes were dangerous. And the tool set that they used then moved to the Hill and Knowlton experts spread out into other professional public relations companies, and then they proceeded to work in the chemical industry, the pharmaceutical industry, the nuclear industry, and in each case, their job was to minimize the public's impression of the hazards that their company's product provided, and then finally, of course, these public relations people, they moved into working on climate change, and they worked for ExxonMobil, and the reason why the United States remains as stupid as it is about climate change is because of the work. Essentially, there were a group of public relations professionals who conducted information warfare on a democratic society, and they made confusion. And the more confusion there is, the less we act, the less we deal with problems, and the less we understand which science is real and which isn't. And so we become confused and stupid. And that was why I wrote that book. I think, ideally, you know, I'd like to think my own writing is the antidote to that. Hopefully that it actually says, no, I'm going to look at science and take science seriously, and I'm going to look for those scientists and respect the process of science that says, wait, we study something, we ask questions about it, we test something, and then we find out, and then we trust those results instead of saying, oh no, we're going to create a whole bunch of paid hacks over here who will try to create another set of false studies. You have to focus on, you know, who's funding science, why that science is happening. But ultimately, like, I think of my work as ideally being connected to true, rigorous science, and that hopefully that's, you know, maybe it's a voice in the wilderness at this point, but you hope that you're having a positive impact on the way that people understand the world and that they actually understand the truths of the world.
En Europe, en tout cas, le doute est constructeur. Le doute, c'est la science, c'est Descartes. Je vais changer de cheval. Si un peu par provocation, je vous déclarais que plus que les auteurs de science-fiction dont vous vous réclamez en tant, par exemple, William Gibson ou Robert Heinlein, comme vos sources ou vos inspirateurs, je vous disais que, en fait, vos inspirateurs, c'est Big Pharma et Monsanto. Vous me diriez quoi ?
In terms of who inspires me as writers, I do hark back to classic science fiction writers. It's Heinlein, it's Gibson, it's Neal Stephenson, it's Ursula Le Guin, and these people, they taught me how to write. The things that give me questions are almost always, it's always a technology, or it's a behavior I see around me in society. I'm looking around at society all the time and looking for, and I don't know why this is, but my particular view on the world is always to look at something that everyone else says is great. And then my personal sort of, my wife just thinks that I just turn everything to shit, but I look at the world and I ask, what could go wrong? What would go wrong with this? What have you not thought of? Oh, you say it's perfect. Well, I can think of 5 different ways that would go wrong. Oh, actually, I think of 6. No, I've thought of 10. And there's something about my personality. I do this in my personal life as well. I think about it every day. You know, how are my finances? Well, they're fine. Oh, well, except for I thought of 10 things that can now go wrong. So it makes me a really miserable personality. But yeah, so when I look at some place like Monsanto, where they come up with a technology and they come up with something like the Terminator gene, which was a genetic modification to seeds to make them sterile. I see that and I think, okay, so I see a profit-driven corporation that's trying to control whether or not seeds can breed. What could possibly go wrong with this? And I think that you know, for me at least, that's really fertile ground to look at, where you see profit-driven corporations looking at food as a place where they can make their money, and you think their job is to maximize profit, and the outcome of that is that they create something like the Terminator gene. So you see where their values are. As soon as they create the Terminator gene, you know exactly where their values are. Their job is to maximize profit. Their job is to make sure that that farmer comes back every year and buys a seed from them instead of replanting the seed. So if we see their values laid out there, then, you know, the classic science fiction question is, if this goes on, what will the world look like? If this becomes the most dominant trend, what will the world look like? And for me, when I look at a company like Monsanto, where their entire existence, it's not their fault that they're evil, their entire existence is driven around profit. They are not about, their advertisements were about feeding people, right? That's their public-facing personas, like, we feed people, we feed the poor, we increase crop yield. That's the advertising side, but what you see their behaviors, when you see them create something like the Terminator gene, that's their values. And so when I'm looking at it as a science fiction writer, I'm like, okay, so let's take those values further out. And that's where you create something like the Wind-Up Girl story, where calorie companies control all of the food supplies. And only the people who can pay, only the people who can come back can get any seeds. And they're so profit-driven, in fact, that they've released plagues that have wiped out all other naturally occurring plant food, you know, food sources, so that they are the sole monopolists of food. And that strikes me as being an entirely reasonable and profitable sort of way to go about things if this is the way you look at the world. And so I wanted to take that and stretch that out. And I think that, you know, ideally, if you, again, stretch it out far enough, people get to live in that world of, this is what a calorie company controlling all of our food really looks like. How do we feel about that? Then when we come back to this moment and you see Monsanto suing a farmer for going to a grain silo and pulling some grain out and planting it, and they say that's an intellectual property infringement, at that moment you go, oh, wait, here's the values, this is the behavior, and I know where this goes. And hopefully there's a better public conversation around it because you had this, you lived in this weird, terrible world where the calorie companies controlled everything.
On va changer de registre, on va aller dans l'intime, là. Vous avez dit à propos de la fille automate que vous aviez choisi la Thaïlande comme lieu du récit entre tous les autres pays d'Asie, parce que c'était un pays qui avait une longue tradition de résistance à l'envahisseur. Et qu'en même temps, dans ce pays, vous aviez contracté une maladie grave, enfin, que vous aviez supposée grave en tout cas. Et est-ce qu'on ne pourrait pas établir une analogie psychique entre votre corps résistant à l'infection et la Thaïlande repoussant les envahisseurs ? On est dans le psy, là.
Well, yeah, so the original idea for the Wind-Up Girl was happened from a collection of different things, but part of it was sort of the madness of sickness, of being sick in Southeast Asia and not really knowing what was going on. And I think Thailand basically infected me in that moment, because there were a couple of different things that happened. One of them was that during the time that my background, again, I studied Chinese. I lived in China for many years. Sometimes I would travel down into the rest of Southeast Asia. On one particular trip, I was traveling through South China just as SARS was happening. And SARS was a sudden acute respiratory syndrome. Okay. And so there was a moment where it really was unclear about how dangerous this disease was, how many people were going to die from it, and how much of a pandemic it was. It really started to spread. And I had traveled directly through the hot zone. And at the time that I traveled through it, China was basically lying about how many infected people they had and what the situation was. So as the news started to trickle out and get more and more clear about what was going on, you know, you would be listening and hearing people around you cough, and you'd suddenly be wondering, like, is this SARS? Like, how bad is this? You know, when you got on a plane, everybody was wearing masks. You know, there was just this strange moment where you had this feeling of pandemic, and you see that thread into the Wind-Up Girl, where people are also worried about plagues that sweep through, and you know, this strange fear, like, is it going to get me? Is this thing coming for me? But But yeah, when I was in Thailand itself, it was during the hot season, and so it felt like the your body is being overwhelmed again and again. You're overwhelmed by the heat. You're overwhelmed by sickness. You're overwhelmed by I was sweating and so hot that my hands started to have blisters on them, and I started to like sort of it was like your whole body was becoming somebody else's body. It was terrifying. And I don't know why, you know, I think that there are certain things that feel traumatic, and so they really burrow into your brain, and they stick with you. And so the very last thing that happened was that as I was leaving Thailand, I was flying back to the United States, and everybody's wearing masks on the plane and stuff because of SARS, and nobody really knows how bad it is. And one of the stewardesses on the airplane that I was on flying to Japan was a Japanese woman, and you couldn't see her face because her face was covered with a mask, but you could see her eyes, and she had these most extraordinary sort of freckles, right, as little sprays of freckles, right on either side of her eye, and they were so perfect that they looked like they might be makeup, or they might have been natural, and you couldn't quite tell. And there was this moment where it's like, is this real, or is this makeup? Is this and then there was the she moved in a slightly jerky way, and it was the strangest thing. I couldn't tell, and immediately it brought to mind cosplay from conventions and science fiction and fantasy conventions, where I was like, she almost seemed to be cosplaying a robot in that moment. And she too stuck in my head, and I got back to the States and I started trying to write stories, and I had this strange desire to write about someone who was, were they human, were they not, what was real, what wasn't, what was natural, what wasn't, and it started to all connect up, everything from Monsanto to Thailand and overwhelming heat and sickness and this strange woman that I'd seen on an airplane, and it all sort of became this swirl, and you never quite know why a story suddenly gains life, but all of those ingredients were there, and suddenly this thing was the most interesting story that I had, and it was the most interesting world that I was creating. And I at that time I was a short story writer and believed I was only a short story writer, and I tried to write a short story about her. And it was really bad. And a friend of mine said, no, this is not a short story. This is a novel. It's too packed together. And I was horrified by that idea at the time because I was so frightened of writing any more books. But eventually I realized that it was the only interesting thing I had in me, and I started writing it. And I was like, okay, it's hard and it's complicated and I don't know what I'm going to do with it. And I'll have to go back to Thailand again and do all of this research now because I'm not qualified to write about Thailand. It all happened.
Alors justement, dans ce roman, La fille automate, c'est en testant les limites de sa programmation qu'elle parvient à la conscience d'elle-même, il me semble. Et elle cesse d'être un esclave en testant les règles. Et dans la nouvelle que vous avez écrite pour l'anthologie des Utopiales et dont le thème est machine, c'est à nouveau une fille robot qui est mise en lumière. Mais celle-ci tente par la simulation de prouver qu'elle a droit à un avocat, que la mort de son propriétaire n'est pas un accident dû à un matériel défectueux, mais un meurtre. Son interlocuteur ne cesse de se répéter qu'elle simule pour mieux se convaincre de la supprimer, tel le simple objet qu'elle est censée être. Mais n'est-ce pas exactement ainsi, en testant les limites, en apprenant d'abord à imiter les codes sociaux, que nous-mêmes, nous devenons humains? Donc, de ce fait, il semblerait que lorsque nous créons des robots, selon vous, pour être nos esclaves, nous créons d'autres êtres humains juste un peu plus solides. Et quelque part, l'esclavage des robots serait une métaphore de l'esclavage réel que nous faisons subir à une partie de la planète. Est-ce que c'est une vision dans laquelle vous vous reconnaissez, là ?
Yeah, I think that so I write about either robots or bioengineered people or enslaved peoples, and I do this again and again. And I didn't realize that it was a pattern for me for a long time. But in The Wind Up Girl, there's Emiko, and she is. Wind ups are explicitly designed to serve human beings, to be almost human but not quite, and to live in that gap of being servile but human. And And that shows up again in my young adult novels, Shipbreaker and the Drowned Cities. I have a character called Tool, and he's a bioengineered war beast. He's a combination of tiger and dog and human and hyena, all of these different components that have been put together, but he's manufactured to be a perfect killing weapon. And he also has been manufactured to be very useful and absolutely obedient. And you do see this. So this is our relationship with, you know, when we create an attack dog. You know, when we train an animal to do our bidding, we explicitly want to reach out and control the things around us. And so there's something about that idea that, you know, we're going to use this technology to try to create beings who are just about like us, but conveniently subservient. There are ethical questions there, and there's some interesting thing about, you know, okay, so now what if I am in that other person's skin, if I'm in the skin of the servant, and that I'm always meant to serve, and what is that to be told that you're always meant to serve, and, you know, whether that's to serve as a warrior, or whether that's to serve as a sex slave, or whether that's a robot, you know, all those different roles that they... that these characters are created in. I'm sort of curious about the idea of what puts us in those roles, and then how we try to define ourselves out, how we try to get our independence, how we try to establish ourselves as being real. And yeah, in Mika Model, the story is really about this robot saying, no, look, I have made decisions here that are just as bad as a human being's. Therefore, I want the law to intervene. I'm not a product defect that should be returned to the factory. I am a problem for you on a legal level because I am real. I am a murderer. Make me a murderer so that I can define me as a murderer so that I can be also recognized as being real. It's interesting as a writer, like the moment you start seeing that you have themes that show up again in your own writing, you're like, oh, I did that again. But it's something that feels very rich. And I'm not actually sure what I'm ultimately solving, but I clearly am coming back to it.
Moi, j'aime bien l'idée que vous définissiez l'humanité comme un tueur à la base, mais bon. Contente. C'est... Alors... Pour votre dernier roman, Waterknife, en 2012, vous disiez que vous l'aviez conçu comme une espèce de geste obscène que je ne qualifierais pas, à l'adresse de Rick Perry, gouverneur du Texas, qui avait une solution absolument géniale au problème de sécheresse de son État. Il a organisé des séances de prière. J'en reste sans voix quand j'ai appris ça. Et donc, vous décrivez cette façon de traiter le problème comme légèrement irréaliste, pour rester dans l'euphémisme. Et pour lui prouver, vous écrivez un roman de science-fiction, ce qui est un genre pas très réaliste. Alors, ça pourrait être un deuxième geste obscène caché dans le premier, mais bon, à nouveau la science-fiction comme pédagogie du réel.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's really frustrating and astonishing to realize that Rick Perry, he was a candidate for president at one point, and considered to be a legitimate candidate for president. And, I mean, obviously, now that we have Trump, we know exactly how crazy America is. But it was frustrating to watch somebody who was a legitimate presidential candidate treat a major drought as if it was driven by God. And to see someone engaging in that kind of magical thinking was horrifying. And again, this is that moment as a science fiction writer where you say, well, if this goes on, what will the world look like? If we treat this moment... And the background of all of this was that Rick Perry was the governor of Texas, and Texas was in a drought that was so bad that... all of the crops were dying in Texas. They were having to kill the cattle on the land, their cows on the land, because the land couldn't support their cattle. You were seeing rolling brownouts. They were running out of electricity because there wasn't enough water in their dams to turn the turbines. You were seeing all of these impacts from drought. And at this moment, Rick Perry, the governor, the leader of Texas, is going around praying for rain. and encouraging people, let's hold prayer circles, let's pray for rain. And you see that moment where, and then the other thing that you could see is like you're in that drought, and the time I was down there, I was in Austin, Texas, and you were in that drought, and you could see how bad it was. And then there was a moment that you could say, oh, wait, I know what the climate data says about Texas. I know what the climate data says about most of the southern United States. And it says droughts like this are highly likely and are likely to be the new normal. So there's a moment where you realize that you aren't actually in a drought. You realize that you're time traveling. In this moment, you've just stepped into the future, and you're seeing what the climate data says we will live in the future. And you can look around and say, well, how does this look? And the answer is, it's really scary. And so if I'm time traveling into the future and I see exactly how bad this future is going to be, I see exactly how dry it's going to be, and I see how our leaders today are planning and preparing for it by praying, then you can start doing the science fictional trick. And you say, if this goes on, what will the world look like? If we continue to pray for rain instead of dealing with the problem, what will the world look like? And then that was the beginning of writing the Water Knife, was trying to say, let's look at this. There's either we will be a data-driven, fact-based society, or we will live with our magical thinking. And what will be the two results? And so it without question is an imaginative exercise, but very explicitly in the story, I have two cities. There's Las Vegas that looks around at the data and says, we live in a stupid place, we have very little water, what do we need to do to plan? And in this future, Las Vegas is doing fairly well because they've been planning in a very hard-eyed way. And then there's Phoenix, who's decided not to plan at all, and they're in the process of falling apart. And you can kind of measure both of those outcomes and see people living inside of both kinds of societies, you know, where the drought is coming. That's the fact. How will we plan for it is the question. And with imagination, hopefully, yeah, then there's a moment where, and certainly I get an opportunity to name the religious fanatics in my book, Mary Perry's, after Governor Rick Perry. And there's some, that is an obscene gesture, right to him. And it's a deep pleasure to do that. but yeah, I think that the objective, though, is to give people the scenarios. It's not to preach, oh, this is smart, this is stupid. It's say, take a look at them. What do you think? Try them out. And, you know, if you want the Phoenix version or if you want the Texas version where everybody sits around praying for rain, by all means, you know, doesn't this look like about what it is?
Alors justement, vous décrivez votre science-fiction comme une distorsion, un filtre, qui met en lumière métaphoriquement ou non certains éléments du monde actuel, ici la sécheresse dans Waterknife et la façon de la traiter. D'une certaine façon, c'est ce que la science-fiction a toujours fait. Mais dans Waterknife, vous avez bien délimité les éléments que vous aviez mis en lumière, mais qu'est-ce que vous avez laissé de côté délibérément, selon vous ? Parce que, par exemple, vous aviez dit pour la fille automate que vous aviez laissé de côté les énergies renouvelables, on vous en avait parlé, etc. Donc, dans Waterknife, vous avez forcément laissé quelque chose de côté. Enfin, peut-être.
Okay, so I think, one of the things that's weird about creating these fictional futures is they are still lies. They are falsehoods in their own ways. They're built with assumptions. And because you want to create an effect, because you want to create a certain experience for the reader. One of the assumptions of the overall book is that we fail to plan and we fail to cooperate. And this is not absolutely true. Those are the preconditions. For the broken future that I create, one of the absolute preconditions is that we fail to cooperate as people. We fail to believe that our neighbor is important. We refuse to believe that the person in the next state is important. We refuse to believe that the person in the next country is important. We live on an illusion instead that I have mine and I can protect it if I can just keep you out. And that is probably the most cynical manipulation that happens in this story. Is the assumption is that people will create insiders and outsiders, and that there will be people who try to say, I win, you lose. there are other ways to solve our problems. You know, there is a utopic version of ourselves which says, no, no, we are all connected. We all have responsibilities towards one another. What happens to you in Syria matters to me in Europe, and maybe I need to be connected to that. What happens to me in Mexico matters to you in America. You know, and there's this moment where there are other choices where we can say, oh, no, these are global problems, and the things that are happening in some place that's poor are intimately connected to those places that are rich. And so I think that, you know, if there's anything about the water knife that's not automatically true, but I'm concerned might be true, it's the idea that we're trying to separate ourselves from one another and that we're not interested in solving the problems of the person next door. And I do think that does lead to disaster, and that's the kind of world I designed.
Alors, dans la littérature de jeunesse, vous n'êtes pas beaucoup plus optimiste. Vous vous êtes lancé avec beaucoup de succès avec les Ferrailleurs des mers ou les Cités englouties, ou encore la Fabrique du doute, comme Enline, dont vous vous êtes réclamé. Est-ce que ce sont vraiment des juvéniles? Qu'est-ce qui est la vraie différence, selon vous, dans votre écriture, à part les scènes de sexe, on va dire qu'il n'y en a pas, hein, normal, entre vos livres jeunesse, enfin young adult, et mettons Water Knife?
I think that for me at least, the biggest difference, yes, in America, like you always cut the sex out for the kids because we're afraid of sex.
Même pour les adultes, hein, honnêtement, vous les enlevez aussi. Pardon.
Yeah. So I think though the biggest difference between writing for young people and writing for adults, it's the question of who you're trying to give the gift of story to. And that's in your mind right from the start. I'm trying to give you a gift of story. I'm trying to give you a gift of story. We automatically communicate with one another based on who we are already in our daily lives. When I talk to a child, I will talk in certain ways. When I talk to a child, I will sit down on their level and I will talk to them across to them. When I talk to a child, I will use different language. When I talk to a child, there's many things that I will do to make sure that I'm connecting with that person that are different from when I'm talking to you, that are different when I'm talking to my wife. All of those things, we change our behaviors all the time. It's no different when you're writing stories. It's the same idea. Who am I trying to connect to? Who am I trying to give a gift of story to? And that's what matters. Once you know that, you do a lot of things automatically. I can't actually piece together, oh, why did I change this piece of language, or why did I tell the story this way, or why did it pace this way? It's because you're trying to connect to that person, and there's so many things we automatically do to connect to that particular person. So it's not really like there's some recipe, some specific, you know, set of instructions that says this is how you write for kids, or this is how you write for grown-ups. It's more like, oh, no, I want to talk to you now. And that's the key difference for me, at least. Practically, like in terms of my own values, one of the things though that I do like about writing for children, especially something like Zombie Baseball Beatdown, which is for younger kids, is that for some reason when I'm writing for kids, I really enjoy telling stories where there's a little more trust between everybody. Everybody treats each other just a little more kindly. And where there's genuine friendships that everybody can trust and rely on. And those things matter to me. And I want to have those things in stories. And I don't, for whatever reason, those don't feel totally true in adult life. For any number of reasons in my own life, probably, but there were some real friendships and real solid friendships of childhood and stuff, and so being able to write for kids, it gives you an opportunity to live in that space, and that's a treasure for me personally, just to be able to be in a spot where I love these kids and I love the fact that they're a team together, that they're connected to one another, that they care about one another. And that's something that I really love being able to engage with. And so it's a difference for me in what I experience about writing for those different age groups personally.
Oui, j'ai l'impression que dans vos romans jeunesse, enfin, young adult, comme on dit, vous essayez de faire émerger un sentiment du collectif, alors que dans vos romans adultes, Vous partez du principe que le collectif est mort. Est-ce que c'est l'idée?
Very much, very much. Yeah, that's and that is that idea that partly I think I just like that feeling of being connected to other people and thinking that we're all together. And it feels true and honest to write that story in for children, partly because I want it to be aspirational maybe. With adults, I feel like we actually spend far too much of our time in this sort of I'm going to get mine to hell with you sort of mode. I think that there's something also for me writing for younger people that I want to create an aspirational or an inspirational feeling, some hope, some sense of hope, even if my world is broken, that there's some sense of hope in the story, some sense of possibility. There's very much that quality. I feel like for adults, oftentimes, I'm trying to really poke an adult and try to make an adult feel a little less comfortable. For a young person, in some way, I'm sort of hoping to inspire or provoke, but not necessarily to, like, incite, I guess. I don't know how you describe that difference of, different kinds of poking. When you're an author, you're always poking at your reader. But with adults, I'm trying to make them more uncomfortable. And with young adults, I'm trying to make them more inspired, I think.
Oui, c'est une vraie différence entre vos dystopies et des dystopies clairement individualistes du type Hunger Games. Et c'est peut-être toute l'explication du succès de Faire allure des mères, c'est qu'on est en train de reconstruire du social, en fait. Dans La fabrique du doute, c'est la même chose. C'est une reconstruction du social qui est totalement niée dans la dystopie habituelle en jeunesse depuis quelque temps. Pourquoi vous expliquez comment, plus généralement, le courant dystopique américain individualiste. Là, je suis méchante avec vous.
I feel like right now American dystopias, when you read them, when you read things like Hunger Games or Divergent or any of a number of other ones, I'm speaking very generally, and so don't repeat any of this anywhere. But I feel like there's those stories. Oftentimes, they're stories of individual empowerment, and they're mythologies that tell kids that they can change the world and that they own the world and that they are essentially chosen ones. And I always have a little bit of a hard time with that because the truth is that kids have no control over what happens to them. They are entirely the victims of our adult decisions. And in the future, they will live in the ruins of the world that we give them. And I feel like that's one of the things, for me at least, writing young adult dystopia or these broken futures that I write, is that I want these stories. The kids don't get to change the world. They get to survive the world. And that's very different. In most of the dystopias that you see in young adult, it's always the kids are going to create a revolution. They're going to change the world. That's not exactly, in my stories, I'm hoping the kids now will change the world because they don't want to end up in the world that I've created down the road. They have to work now, though. And that's something that's very, very different about our approaches in terms of, it's just that by the time my stories are happening for kids, they get the scraps and the rubble. They're left with the last pieces of our world that because we adults broke it for them. And they can blame us for it, but that's the facts. If we hand them off junk, that's what they get. And the kids don't get a chance to create a revolution for that. They're just like, no, sorry, we gave it to you. I'm so inspiring.
Alors, il nous reste peu de temps. Le thème cette année, c'est machine. Quelle machine vous allez m'inventer, Paolo Bassigaloupi, pour le futur? Inventez-moi une machine, une bonne, une mauvaise, comme vous voulez. Ou une machine. Là, maintenant, comme ça, vous avez 3 minutes.
So I think that, one of the things that's interesting to me about any given machine is it's never whether or not this machine will be good or bad. It's about whether or not the people who invented it are intending it for good or bad purposes, essentially. Right now, every machine that we create is created for profit purposes. We don't tend to create machines for humanitarian purposes. We don't put the investment behind them because humanitarian purposes don't create cash. The in The Water Knife, I invent a whole sequence of machines that are all dedicated towards water purity and towards recycling water. But they're only given to the rich. It's technology that only the rich can buy. And I think, you know, and then I invent something like the clear sacks for the poor. And clear sacks are they're water purification devices, but they're basically these high-tech plastic bags that people can urinate into. And then when they squeeze the bag, it filters the urine and you can drink it again. And they're reusable a certain number of times, but then they run out, basically, and so then people throw them away and they get scattered all over the streets and get caught in the cactus in Phoenix and things like that. And you know, there's the arcologies where they're doing sort of a more holistic thing where these whole big cities are basically recycling everything and doing it very well and doing it very cleanly and very, very efficiently. And then there's these disposable clear sacks for the poor. And I think that's sort of the range of what we do, and it cuts to kind of where our values are too, which is, you know, we create, you know, the clear sacks, they solve a problem, but they also create more problems because they're a waste problem, but there's no profit in solving that problem. So, oh well, it's just garbage in the street now. And then there's this other version, which is we'll make a really clean and very excellent version of it, but it's only for the rich. And it's like all of the solving the problem of recycling water can be gone at with multiple different technological strategies, but there's something about our values and who we're actually trying to serve that's going to drive what kind of machine or what kind of technology we create. And that's, to me, the most interesting thing. It's never the technology itself. It's the people who are creating it and who they're trying to help and how well they thought out the consequences of the technology or the machine that really where all of the meat of story is and where all of the potential for asking questions is. So that's, you know, the water treatment, two versions.
Merci beaucoup. Nous avons terminé, hélas. Peut-être une question dans l'assistance, éventuellement. On a peut-être le temps, une minute, parce qu'on est on a commencé un peu en retard. Quelqu'un? Non, alors, merci de nous avoir écoutés. Merci, Paolo. C'était très enrichissant.